guidelines for writing a group oil history or a group A group history, and there's also a little bit of a promotional endeavor regarding the National Archives workshops and flyers. I'll have them up here on the back table at the conclusion. If you're interested, come on up and help yourself. Okay. Let's have a moment of silence to contemplate why we're here and what we're about. And so I would need to introduce myself at this point. I'm Gary Klustall. I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here and glad to be sober. I am the immediate rotated past chair of the Trustees Archives Committee. I'm a general service trustee, or regional trustee, rather, on the General Service Board from the Southwest region. And my sole and single responsibility here today is to touch the rocket off and... And the folks that we have gathered up here, I'm sure have many, many years of collective experience that they want to share with you, and some in a specific way, I'm quite sure, and some in a general way. And we're going to cover all the bases and all of the ramifications and possibilities that you could ever envision or imagine with respect to the archival activities in your group, district, area, and so on and so forth. The topic for the meeting, which may not end up where we're going to start, but it says archives, a collective vision, and we have this collection. This, I'm sure they'll do just fine. And I'll be real honest with you, at these deals, there's so many of us, and we get spread pretty thin, we don't really get a lot of time to spend together and really get to know each other as we properly should. Alcoholics Anonymous, as we all know, is a pretty small world and at the end of the day, and it's certainly one of the joys of my sobriety, and I'm sure yours has been that you get an opportunity to meet folks along the way who have these same deep and abiding passions for this thing that we love and that saved our life. And so without any further stuff from me, I'd like to introduce our first hitter. Vicki Jo from Arizona. She is the Arizona Area Archivist from Area 3. Vicki.
Tough act to follow. Hi, everybody. My name is Vicki Jo B., and I am an alcoholic. And I'm currently blessed to be able to serve the Arizona area as the archivist. I served as the Panel 50 delegate. That was 2000 and 2001. And this is what they do with past delegates. They don't know what else to do with us. They stick us in archives. So, that's just right. I want to thank our Arizona delegate, Art Regan, for inviting me to do this and for Judith just extending me this opportunity. I'm really blessed. I got my start in archives long before I knew anything about archives. I collect everything. Ask my husband. We have a den from Hades. I have boxes and files of files and boxes and vice versa, and I never realized that it was going to be important one day. I just hate throwing things away. My sponsor was a past delegate and also became the Arizona archivist, and she had been an archivist for some time. Actually, there had only been one other person to precede her, Pat P., whom we just recently lost. Anyway, she got me started with the area archives in setting up the displays, and what one of my our traveling archives, one of my friends always refers to as the dirty t-shirt and dirty coffee cup display, as we, you know, t-shirt from this convention and that thing and coffee cups from everywhere. You know, Bill W.'s statement, and I'm sure this isn't foreign to any of you, about the beginnings. Every one of the new and unexpected developments in AA has lying just underneath an enormous amount of dramatic incident and experience, stories galore. It isn't hard to prepare a fact sheet of what happened, that is, dates when people came in, etc. The hard thing to lay hold of is the atmosphere of the whole proceedings. and anecdotal material that'll make the early experience alive. Like, I don't know about your home groups, but I know when the minutes are read, we say the Lord's Prayer. It doesn't tell you anything about the amount of chairs that were thrown or any of the spirited discussions that passionate alcoholics can get into. And that's really the touchstone, is the atmosphere. Experience indicates, of course, that the archives should be housed in a rented space rather than a private home. I have copies of lots of stuff in my home. We do have an air-conditioned storeroom where the Arizona Area Archives are housed. You know, it's always nice if you can have a permanent repository, and one of the suggestions in the archives workbook is that it could even be adjacent to your intergroup. Well, we couldn't do that in Phoenix, where I'm from, because we have four intergroups. Something to do with resentments, coffee pots, and a broom. I don't know. Anyway, it is in our history. And also, when people know where the archives are or that they're going to be on display, they seem to be much more generous. We do not collect. We do not trade. We do not barter. We do not sell. If you gave me a first edition of the big book and offered to sell it to me, I could pay $5.75 for it. That is not the case online. I understand they go for a lot of money. And that's another thing, is that the onus of, like, the big book and General Service Conference material is on GSO. It's not necessarily on our area. Our area archives are just that, our history, our minutes of our proceedings, our group histories and long-timers' experiences. In starting out with this thing, I have been trying to write the Arizona area history, and I have to tell you, the thing about group histories is wonderful. Long-timer histories are much more fun. But you need to get two of them. Always good to get two long-timers together to do one interview. Because what happens, and Pat P. is a good example, I did the interview with him, and his wife had been heavily involved in AAA, the predecessor to Al-Anon. And she sat there, and he bounced things off her, and that was great. When you do a single interview with a long time, they have a tendency to forget, or, gosh, it was this place over there, I think the name was. And then what we've done is we've tried to always transcribe those tapes right away, send them back to the person that we interviewed so that they could add, delete, mark up, whatever. The first thing Pat did, would you take out that piece where I called that guy an SOB and take out that other piece where I called this guy a liar? And, you know, we transcribe. That's literal. They're a lot of fun, though. And it's even more fun when you get two of them who don't agree. Then you have to get a third person to verify what any one of the first two are saying. And this is why the history takes so long, because you just don't know. One of the most important functions, I think, of an archives committee is to determine what you're going to save. Now, we occasionally have what I call a sorting party, and we'll go in and grab a box, and we sort into categories in Arizona. One's archival, one's memorabilia, one's historical, and the fourth category is other. Arizona is a huge retirement community. So we end up with stuff from other areas, and I've had occasion to send things to the archivists from those areas when they've been donated to us, and I think that's very important that we remember, you know, even though they belong to this person, those are archives that maybe their archivists don't have, and to keep an open line of communication. The other thing that I understand is very important to me personally is that you go through the delegate to find out who your area's archivist is. There are a lot of people who do collections and savings and, yeah, there are lots of collectors, and we are not. You know, we just aren't. Ours, I believe, I could say this without a doubt, are spiritually based. I think that when somebody knows that when they donate to the Arizona area, that if their things go on display, that that's part of our archives. I heard that at the last National Archives workshop, and I just loved it. Our areas consist of the minutes, the delegates' memorabilia, oh boy, and there's a lot of that, pictures and flyers of events, early correspondence, books, pamphlets, long-timers' tapes, memorabilia, and final conference reports, newspaper clippings. And I know that it's helpful for the archivist to have familiarity with the archival procedures and willingness to learn some of the basics. The local high schools, colleges, or major libraries may have some basic courses in handling historical records. What I've been privileged to be a part of four times is the National Archives Workshop. I got to go to the first one. That was in Akron, Ohio, and we got to go to those places where we started and get some experience as to what we can actually do as far as deacidification, preservation, restoration, and the techniques that are involved. And this isn't somebody that a novice can just come in and do. However, if you go to the GSO website and you go to archives, it'll tell you, okay, read your big book and AA comes of age. We don't have a lot as far as archives to tell us how to do our jobs as far as the restoration, the preservation, the deacidification. Those are really things you need to take classes in, and this archives workshop has just been a phenomenal asset to area archivists to help us do what we're supposed to be doing. Judith has attended several times, and I'm sure that if Frank were still around, those of you who know Frank M., he would just absolutely love him. One of the most marvelous examples of restoration and preservation were one of the gals from one of our little outlying areas, a small town called Bisbee, sent me a big book. It had belonged to her sponsors. It was a first edition, third printing, and it was in three pieces. The cover was ratty inside. It was all taped. It had articles. The pages were all just nasty. And because of the archives workshop, I knew a person to send this book to. And he restored this to such pristine condition that if you just looked at the outside, you wouldn't know that it was an old book. That's also in our traveling archives with the before and after pictures. This ultimately is what I would love to be able to do with some of those old papers, the ones that you're afraid to touch because they crackle, et cetera, and fall apart when you touch them, which you really shouldn't. And the more you take these things out, like I say, I have traveling archives. Most of that is copied because you don't want to take your originals out. They're damaged every time there's fluorescent light, anytime there's heat. There's very few original things that I really like to take around. And I got to send that gal a copy of that book, actually. The items that are of historical import to Arizona, well, they're precious, absolutely precious, just like our long-timers. And I've really been trying to interview a lot of the long-timers. It's fun. My gosh, have you ever sat down and talked to a long-timer about specifics? The anecdotal things are just incredible, like, well, when I started to put together a past actions of some of our area stuff, I realized that we were missing a huge portion of our history as far as the Arizona events went. One of our area secretaries had gotten ticked off and had torched the minutes. We have put out several calls to people to see if they have those, and unfortunately that's a part of our history that so far is just gone. Oh, yeah. Big resentment. Yeah, exactly. It is the number one offender, and unfortunately. But what we hope to do one day is have a permanent repository. You know, what I would love to be able to do is come into a place where I could do research, where I could sit down, find out who, when, where, what. I know why. We want to stay sober one day at a time. But, you know, knowing how things started, you know, the miraculous series of events that is created in a home group, my gosh, for a home group to survive, for two drunks to not kill each other. I mean, it's just, there's God's hand in all of this. But I would love to have a place where you could come in and do the research. You could come in and see what the early things were, the old pamphlets. I had a marvelous opportunity to get a hold of a couple of old pamphlets. One of our district committee members had been going through his literature rack at the club where his meetings were, and he found some pamphlets from 1970. I guess they didn't rotate those a lot. Anyway, so I was very glad that he gave those to us, because it shows, and we are able to show, the growth and the change. I mean, our artwork isn't anywhere near the same as it used to be, and it's fascinating to me. How many of you have ever gone into the Grapevine's digital archives? Isn't that incredible? Oh, I just love that. Not that we will ever get there. I'm just starting to scan and copy documents. We are charged with the gathering of group and personal histories. We are charged with the care and responsibility of those items which are given to us in trust to share with others. I am absolutely blessed to be able to take care or babysit for this time the Arizona Area Archives. Like I say, I have lots of hopes that one day we will have that permanent repository and a place where you can come and browse and see what we were like and what happened as a result of that, and learn from our mistakes and not torture our minutes, because I was the area secretary. I felt like it one time too, but I am just so blessed. Thank you so much for listening.
I want to deviate from the program for just a moment, and I'd like a lot of you are obviously archives fanatics and have been at it for a while and probably know some of the players, at least at the office level, but some of you might not. And so I know she gets embarrassed, but Dr. Judith Olaf is in the audience. She's the area or the archivist at the General Service Office. And she's probably trying to, like, just be quiet and be like a mouse in the corner, but we're not going to let her get away with it. She does, she and her staff do yeoman work on behalf of the fellowship in preserving our critical history. And there's another individual in the room that I'd like to, he hates it when I do this, but I'm going to anyway. His association with Alcoholics Anonymous dates to the earliest of times of the formation of the conference. And he started out his professional life as an attorney for Bernard Smith. And he's in with us today. He's a past chairman of the board, now trustee emeritus, Michael Alexander. Now, Michael is a storyteller, and so if you'd like to hear some stories about the early times and the creation of the conference process and some of the pieces that went into that, there's your source. He's quite a character in the cast of characters that is Alcoholics Anonymous, and a non-alcoholic, so we can't necessarily blame him for anything. Yeah, right. But it's his service to this fellowship that I think he loves probably as much as you and I do has been exemplary over the years. And he's been with us a long, long, long time. And so if you get a chance out in the hallway, you know, and I know there's a lot of people out there, but know him and sit down and visit and let him tell you a story too. He's a good storyteller. If he drank a little more, he might make it in, but you know. Okay, I apologize to the panel for taking that time, but you know, this is a kind of a breathe-as-we-go deal, so we're going to move right along. The next presenter is Jerry P. from Illinois. He's the Area 20 Northern Illinois Archivist.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jerry P. and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. It's good to be with you this afternoon. Wish I wasn't quite so nervous, but I am, and that's the way it goes. I'm currently serving Area 20 Northern Illinois as the appointed archivist, and have been now for about 4 years. I live in a small town called Sycamore, Illinois. My wife, Irene, and I is with me here this afternoon. It's also good to see friends from close-by communities, Aurora and other places. And some of our area members, service members, are here today. And that always makes me feel good when that happens. Area 20, Northern Illinois, is part of the East Central Region, United States. My home group is a Sunday morning open speaker meeting at a hospital in a town close to Sycamore. And I'm currently serving that group as a chairperson for the steering committee. I would like to thank a lot of people up here, certainly GSO Archives, Judith, Michelle, and Noelle, GSO staff, including Doug R., wherever he is, and the Toronto Intergroup for making this such a memorable weekend for us. I think they've done an outstanding job of putting this convention together.
They have.
I didn't realize there were that many people named Jerry until I got up here. Every other person I met was Jerry. That's a good thing. I'd like to tell you a little bit about my recent past. You may not be able to discern this, but I'm past the legal retirement age. Yeah. I'm currently working at a high school in the town we live in as a dean's assistant. And if you ever heard the story about finally finding a job you really like, you don't have a job anymore, that's what I have, guys. The interface with my teenagers is about 1,100 teenage students and 150 faculty and staff. My wife and I chaperone dances that the kids have. We went to the prom, sporting events, you name it. And that keeps me young, helps keep me young, and that's a good thing, something I'm really grateful for. I mentioned that I was a panel 48 delegate to the General Service Conference. I'd like to talk just a couple minutes about that. 1998, as a first-year delegate to the conference itself decided, voted, to have a archives committee made up of delegates. First time ever. It's a secondary committee, and we approved that as a conference. Between my first year delegate and being the second year delegate from Illinois, I received a letter from GSO asking if I would be a member of this archives committee, conference archives committee. Of course, the answer was yes. That second year in 1999, on a Wednesday night, the trustees and the conference delegates met for the first time. And I don't know how much we really accomplished, maybe a lot, but one of the things we did was to devote some time to our mission statement. And we didn't come up with any advisory actions, but we made some recommendations to the conference, and that was one of them. The second thing that we did was to request a archival workbook that was perhaps a little more current and factful than the one that was available published in January of 89. During this Wednesday night meeting, they also elected the first conference archives chairperson. And I stand before you today as a humble, trusted servant, having been elected to that conference committee. I was able to make a report to the entire General Service Conference as to what we discussed in our joint trustee and delegate meeting. The theme of this particular workshop we're in now is our collective conscience. And, Lord, when I think back about what's happened to me since I've gotten sober, it just blows me away. First of all, getting sober. And then, I got involved with some people early on in recovery. My sponsor was active in service, and where he went, I went. What he did, I tried to do. I met some gentlemen early on who are now past delegates from our area who had a significant impact on me. One of these gentlemen, I had a question about a grapevine item, and my sponsor said, well, why don't you call our standing delegate and ask him? And when I got sober, one of my problems was my lack of self-esteem and sense of self-worth. So I did call this gentleman, and by golly, he called me back. And that was like a turning point. As insignificant as that may sound, for me, that was a turning point because this gentleman thought enough to return my phone call and has since become a very, very dear friend. As a point in fact, he has also been a recent past East Central Regional Trustee. God bless him. My collective vision, I'm not sure I can tell you in the next 8 minutes what that is. In chapter 11 of our big book, the title of that is A Vision for Us. And looking through some materials to kind of share with you today of what my collective vision is, I come across things like I will find release from care, boredom, and worry. My imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfying years of my existence lies ahead. I heard a speaker not long ago say, be careful in sobriety that you don't accept what you see happening in your life as the final step in your recovery. Life continues to get better, and things are happening in my life today that I just kind of sit back and say, wow, that's true for me. That's happened to me. And my wife and I celebrated our first wedding anniversary last week, first year of being together, and she is truly a gift from my higher power. Area 20, Northern Illinois, does have a repository. It's in a public storage unit that is climate controlled. Unfortunately, it's about 10 by 10. And you can open the door and then you better step back. It's obviously getting too small for the kinds of records we feel we need to keep in our repository. what we emphasize, what we take care to include in our repository, or things like any group information within our area, any district information, minutes, financial reports, seminars, workshops, and certainly at the area level, all pertinent data that that makes the area tick. We have it in somewhat of a respectable order. But if you were to ask me for the minutes of the December 23rd District 71 minutes, I'd probably have to tell you I'll get back to you. You know, the theme of this international convention is I am responsible. And I think that somehow ties in with the topic of this workshop, is our collective conscience. Because I think it has to start with me, or you. You know, and I have heard it many, many times that I am responsible to share my experience, strength, and hope with others. Exactly. And I repeat the word exactly as it was given to me. And that exactly comes from our three legacies, steps, traditions, and concepts. So I want to thank everyone for listening and being here, and those responsible for this whole affair. Thank you.
Our presenters thus far have touched on a couple of items that possibly might bear some expansion in your own group, district, area, intergroup conscience. One piece is this nebulous after considerable discussion. Those three words somehow fail to capture the spirit with which we debate things. And what we all really want to know is Bill through the Stapler Act, isn't it? We want the details. And we have no investment in the outcome. We just want to make sure the details are covered. And so, you know, as we've matured as a fellowship, I suppose we've gotten away some of our frontier living reporting techniques, and we've gotten fairly sterile, I suppose, and almost to the point where we fail to capture, I think, some of the spirited debates that occur within this fellowship at all levels, quite frankly. And so maybe it's a function of maturity. Maybe it's a function of that old thing that's in each and every one of us to be accepted in our peers as a society. I don't know where it comes from, but it comes from somewhere, certainly. And there are times that I kind of really want to read those conference reports and then to ask myself, was that the conference I was at? Or is this somebody's, you know, latest version of the truth of how that happened? And, of course, as committees, you will have to face certainly some challenges in your work, one being the continuing difficulties that we experience as a fellowship across the board in this business of self-support. And I think sometimes that we need to be really truthful as committees to our area assemblies and whatnot about the true nature and the true extent of the cost of some of these endeavors. And we all face the challenges of the technology for recording, preserving materials, and making them available. The electronic media certainly has opened up some tremendous avenues for some communication of this stuff, all within our traditions, which makes for an interesting discussion, to say the least. And perhaps present some difficulties in implementation that we're certainly not, have not achieved the group conscience on yet. We just don't know. Group conscience, as those of you, most of you know probably, is always a work in progress. And of course we face the inevitable difficulties with the challenge of the sixth tradition, which encourages us never to accumulate large matters of property, but yet we know that much of the material that's available out there is the artifact, not the spiritual value of the artifact, the language, the words that's on there, but the artifact itself. And this has created a market that we know is lending itself to some contravention of Tradition 6 in its long form. And so these are challenges that these committees will, and certainly individual archivists that are appointed, what is the word, permanent archivist? I don't even know what that is. What is that, 7 years? A GSR is about 90 days, so I think we could figure 5 to 7 years and your permanence is expired. But you know, these kinds of things all need to be fleshed out. And so I'm sure as we go along with these presentations, you'll be making some observations on some of the challenges that you face in your own endeavors. Our third presenter is the archivist for the GTA AA. I thought AAA was the successor to AA, actually, because we had the first two letters in the phone book. And, we're not going to be, we're number three. Now I find out AAA is the predecessor to Al-Anon. So GTAA is another thing that will be explained, I'm sure. Myra, from Ontario.
Yeah, I'm learning some really interesting stuff up here. Good afternoon, friends. I am an alcoholic, a member of the Leslie Group here in Toronto. My name is Myra O'Brien. And I also have the honor and privilege of serving the Greater Toronto Area of Alcoholics Anonymous as the archivist. And that's kind of an anomalous position because it also includes archives that really range across the whole province. But that's a whole story in and of itself, which is in this book. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about that in a second. And the beginning of this book writes... the beginning of this book writes, and some of you know that one of the key authors on this book is Tom Hills, who was a former delegate here and a former Eastern Canada Regional Trustee, also sat on the Archives Committee, that Alcoholics Anonymous arrived quietly in Canada, Ontario to be exact, on January 13, 1943, and the first meeting was held without fanfare at the Little Denmark Restaurant, and present were Reverends George Little and Percy Price, accompanied by six alcoholics. Enough interest was shown in the initial meeting that a second meeting was scheduled and held 1 week later, and so Alcoholics Anonymous in Ontario was born. And if Tommy Hills was standing here, he'd probably say, well, actually it was in Canada, but there's contention about that, and hence the importance of archives. So that was about 62 years ago, and 8 years behind when Bill and Bob met, and 10 years behind, give or take a few, behind when the Oxford Group brought their attention and focused on the alcoholics. And how do we know that? Why does it matter? Who cares? Who cares? Why do you care? And that's what we were doing here as archivists. I'm an archivist by default. I went through university, and I have a mental obsession about filing paper that kind of qualified me to be the archivist for the GTAA. When Tommy Hill passed away a few years ago, the archives committee of this era, of this region, and it really was this region, had its house, so to speak, in the Toronto Intergroup offices. But there were some long-timers on there who had a love and affection and care for Alcoholics Anonymous is unparalleled. I have really big shoes to fit into. But the collection that was brought together started back in 1943. There's a collection in the Toronto Intergroup offices. We've honored the request of General Service Office not to display our stuff out there somewhere, and so we've made it accessible to you, so please come and see them at 234 Eglinton Avenue East on the second floor. It's humble, but it's there for you to see. That collection was made possible by the third delegate to Ontario, Ontario, Whit H. from Sarnia. His sponsor got sober in 1943, Fred H. from London. Why does that matter? Who cares? When I was thinking about this collective vision, why is that so, I mean, that gives me goosebumps. Why? And so that's something about the collective vision. And we in Alcoholics Anonymous have this oral tradition. We're forever telling stories. You've been telling some pretty cool ones up here. And then Mike's in the back there. And I think, wow. And I'm on the elevator at the Royal York today, and I see a General Service Conference badge, and I'm looking at it, and it's Elsie Norris. Oh, Elsie, wait a second. And I've been talking to Gordon Patrick, because he lives here in town. And this is powerful stuff. And so this oral tradition, we're telling all these little stories, and it makes us have all those goosebumps we've been having all weekend. And it's just like when we drank. Oh, let me tell you a story. My brother used to, we always used to say, this guy who hung around in the corner in our town, he said, Mike, we know what you're telling us is the truth. We just don't know if it's you're telling us a story. We just don't know if it's true or not. We believe what you're saying. We just don't know if it's true or not. So we love to tell stories, and we love to tell them in Alcoholics Anonymous. And historians and archivists like those of us up here, we love those too, but we love to delineate myth from fact. And it's really important to do that. We preserve the past as a segue into our present and as a secure future. Because what is the message that we're carrying? What is that primary purpose? How do we know what it is? It's so it doesn't get too diluted. That's what our vision is of the future. And it's in the big book, and it's really quite simple, but it could get different in the telling if we don't write it down. And some of us would say some of those stories are bull. I mean, curse from the podium, but we have a tendency to glorify the past or reify the journey of how we got here and how each of us, all that fellowship stuff. The newcomers have a hard enough time reading the big book. It's in the book. $20 or something? It's in the book, and they won't read that. Have a hard enough time reading that or the 12 and 12. Try and get them to read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. There's some pretty good fact in there, and it's corroborated by hard evidence. It's stories, but they have fact behind them. Or more importantly for all of us, is AA comes of age. I mean, a newcomer's not going to read the big book. You want them to read AA comes of age, dry, boring stories with guys in suits and old priests, and it's not attractive unless we can make it attractive. And so, but those stories are important because they are our present, they are our past, and they will be our future. We're in the second and third generation of alcoholics, so it's so important. I mean, when we write that big book, I missed Gail's talk this afternoon because we were doing something else. But, you know, writing the big book, because we're getting too far away from Akron, we're getting too far away from New York. Is it going to work in Los Angeles? Is it going to work in Texas? And so we got to write that down and pass on what we've done. So, you know, how the message was carried to us does matter. When I mentioned about George Little and Reverend Percy Price, they brought the big book to alcoholics in Canada. And that is so important for us to remember. There's a picture in this book of 2 Girard Street, where one of our first intergroup office was, and one of our long-timers, and we have it in our traveling display, one of our long-timers, I was telling a friend here at the meeting, in our traveling display, was touching it. He's over 30 years, he's touching it. What's up, Ray? You know, big tears coming down his face. What's up with that, Ray? Because, you know, 35 years ago, Ray was standing at the door, pushed on the door, and he went and sat back in the big old Chrysler there, and, you know, sat there for half an hour shaking and shivering, and then, you know, get out of the car and went and pushed on the door, and that stuff makes it important. It makes our long-timers keep coming back, and it makes it so important. It matters who these people were. It matters how we got it. It matters how we carry it forward, and that's why the work of truly skilled and professional archivists, like our archivists at the General Service Office, and Vicky Joe, you did a hell of a job over here. I'm just new at this job, relatively, and so my job is to try and, as a custodian of the collection that was brought to those offices from 1943 to the present, is preserved for my children. What's the story they're going to tell yours? I mean, am I going to tell somebody in Vancouver? No way. Alcoholics Anonymous started in Toronto, dude. Not in Sarnia, not in Vancouver. It started right here. And what are the facts about that? How did we get the traditions? Why did we have the traditions? All these things matter, and that's about our collective vision. I mean, and that's the story I have here to tell you. I could tell you lots of stories about stories that we tell about how I got the collection and how Ontario General Service grew and how that, you know, sort of evolved into the Delegates Committee and then the areas and things. But you don't want to hear about all that dry and boring stuff. You can come and see it in our offices, or you could read the book. and it's in the book. The interesting, the story that led to tell in Canada, particularly because you have quite a large group of First Nations peoples, and Bob Pelleau, our Eastern Canada Regional Trustee, that has done a lot of work with the Innu in northern Canada and northern Quebec. Oh man, the stories Bob tells about that in the last regional forum in Montreal, Saint-Hyacinthe, was brilliant. How do we get the 12 steps and 12 traditions in Innu? That story is important because if an Inuit cannot read the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, their community is not going to stay sober. That's so important. And that's the message. That's the vision. One alcoholic talking to another and sharing the spiritual journey that brought him back from the gates of hell and death. That stuff's in the book. And all that dry, boring paper, filing cabinets, lights, and controlled, turn you on and keep us really busy. It's the very fabric of who we are. There's one more story. There's actually a whole bunch of them, but I remember talking to a diplomat in Ottawa and coming back from telling us stories. You know, what happened? How did our fellowship start somewhere? And we were showing people, we're trying to sell this book yesterday. I'm not going to do that here. But I'm telling you that because we're trying to tell a story about how the message got carried in Sri Lanka. And the way this diplomat tells it now needs to be corroborated with fact. I need another person to back that story up. But this guy found a big book, a Sri Lankan, a Sinhalese speaker, found a big book somewhere. They're drunks. They wanted to get sober, and as Sinhalese speakers, their characters, it's different. They couldn't read the book, and it's just after the war, and they're still part of the Commonwealth, and the ships are coming in. The big ships are coming in, the sailors coming in, Americans, Canadians, and these little guys had that big book, and you know, the ship's pulling in, you can go and check it out. They walked from the very bottom of the ship to the very top deck like this with the big book. Until somebody recognized the big book. Is it truth? It is to me. They finally found a sailor, an officer on top deck. And that's the beginnings of AA in Sri Lanka, as I've heard it. So the stories matter, and that's the vision. Take it home with you. Take it back to your neighborhood. Collect the histories, because it's part of our future and our past. Thank you.
One of the things as the trustee on the archives committee, at trustees level, the board, is that we have to kind of tend to interpret what we think you want. And then we have to match that with what we got. And then we're going to try to figure out how to get the two to meet and kiss. And that's a great challenge, a continuing challenge. Y'all are very vocal in your desires, and I thank you for that. I thank you for that. We do have a general and an overall sense as a board, certainly, and our archive staff enjoys a complete support of our General Service Committee, and that is that we believe that you want us to preserve your materials as they relate especially to the origin of the greatest story that I have ever heard in my life, and that's the story of how we got here. From our origins in the mire of the Depression and Prohibition and all the related disorders that were going on at that time to our 70th birthday this weekend and thereafter as long as God intends this thing to be here. It is our view further that God intends it to be here a lot longer than some of us think it'll be here. And so our job is to help God by doing the footwork down here. And part of that, certainly a huge piece of that, is, as has been said so many times up here today, the collection of this critical, critical history of where we came from, where we're about. And I used to often wonder, as a trusted servant, working my way down through the food chain, not knowing that's what I was doing, I used to wonder, what possible use is the archives to this effort of carrying the message to the alcoholic who still suffers? And I believe it is this and nothing else. That as a sponsee sponsored properly in all three legacies of our miraculous program, that this story must not die. It must not change. It must not be altered. There's a lot of folks, I bet this is your surprise button's probably going to go on right now. There's a lot of people trying to rewrite our history. I know. I just, you know, but it's the way it is. It's how we are. The longer I'm sober, the drunker I got. You heard that one. Okay. So I think it's a critical piece. I am satisfied today, not only on the representations of our staff, but on my personal investigation into the facts, that we have the definitive history of the formation of Alcoholics Anonymous. It needs no embellishment, no amplification, and no interpretation. The facts speak for themselves. And our last presenter is BJF from Eastern Pennsylvania, Area 59, Arkansas.
My name is... I'm not used to this. I usually speak without... My name is BJ, and I am an alcoholic. And because of AA, I didn't pick up a drink today, and that makes it physically impossible to get drunk. I want to... Being an archivist, one of the things I have is curiosity. If I'm watching the movie The Alamo, I want to know why less than 200 Americans stood there against 13,000 Mexicans and nobody left. And I look for every version of that, which I can. I've read just about every book that's for, against, pro, on alcohol, alcoholism, and our fellowship. The Oxford Group and their four absolutes, I can tell you and I can assure you, with the four absolutes, I wouldn't be a member of AA. Yeah, that's how tough they looked to me as I looked at them. But they had a great effect on us. I find it fascinating that the Washingtonians started with six drunks sitting in a tap room, you know, in a tavern in Baltimore, Maryland. Yet we can't tell you what happened to them at the end in most cases. We can look back in the Old Testament and you'll find some entertainment. Solomon wrote a psalm, he wrote it. And it goes like this, I'm taking the vowels out of it. He says, a cup of wine is like a serpent. It will lead me to wicked ways and to wicked women, but I know I will drink again. Now, I like the wicked women part. I've been married 34 years, and my wife likes the wicked women part too, but that's another story. But it's an interesting statement to be made, a recognition he had a problem. In his own words, he recognized the problem, but knew he would drink again. And it's sometimes important to know who said it. Let me give you an impact statement. Happened in the 70s. Mother Teresa, at a celebration in New York, was being interviewed, and she was asked this question. What is the saddest thing you've ever seen in your life? Now, this woman has seen it all. She said, the loneliness of an alcoholic. If I said that, it's not as significant. But because this woman, not a member of AA, but a woman who 12-stepped so many people in many directions and helped the world, it's a powerful statement. We must maintain them words. And who said it? Our beginnings are covered, as the chairperson was saying here. There's no more reason to read. You know, it's funny. If somebody were to offer me a first edition right now, I'd call Judith and say, you want it? Because I sometimes think somebody went out there and printed another 2,000 first editions so that they could sell them or something. It's eccentric. We had a manuscript go for an astronomical figure last year. A few years back, I found a manuscript by Bill's secretary. Judith was at an event in Lancaster with me. And she was wondering where I was getting all this information I was sharing. I said, I got a manuscript here from his... secretary. She says, we don't have it. I just turned around, gave it to her. That's where it belonged. Anything original, on original material, belongs to the whole. Belongs to New York. Me, I maintain copies. The reason being, it takes all monetary value out of it. You don't have any debate on the monetary value of it. Somebody comes in and wants to borrow something, I have another copy. And maintain copies. New York maintains all the other stuff. And I can always call them and say, I need another copy of what I gave you. Well, you know, it's interesting how it works. What I want to focus on is the collective vision of today. If you're just starting out in archives, start collecting material at your next meeting. The old stuff will come back behind it. Start your filing system. Start filing everything today. You can always work forward or you can work backwards as material comes in. Don't stop because you say, I don't have anything. You do. You have today. You have today. At our area, this year we will complete, roughly we have 1,500 groups. By the way, my home group is the Croydon Group in eastern Pennsylvania. Many people say their group is the best group in AA. Mine is the sickest in AA. And the reason being, we're mentioned in the big book. Some people are sicker than others. They just all happen to meet in the Croydon group. And if you were to ask them the question, who am I? They would say, well, he's the one that gives us a bad name. So I thought I would mention, we meet Tuesdays and Thursdays. But I love my home group. And I love what I see there. And this is important. This is where I believe the archives has to continue. We maintain 1,500 groups. We have at least their name on a piece of paper in each of the districts. If we even don't have a story. And sometimes somebody will walk in and say, well, that's my home group. Tell us the story, how it began. Well, I don't know. Is it there today? Yes. Put it down. Sometimes we get so obsessed with yesterday. We're covered there. No one's going to change AA history. We won't even let them change the grammar in Dr. Bob's story. So no one's going to change the origination. That's an inside joke for me. English 101. I want to tell you five stories, and you might be able to relate your own areas. And this, everyone in this room can do. When you sit there and you see something happen, and you clarify it a miracle because you saw it, write it down. Then give it to the area archivist, your district, DCM, to someone. It must be maintained. Because it's the stories of the rooms. I'm going to give you an example. There was a woman who used to come into this meeting down in Kensington, which is in Philadelphia. She used to walk in the room, pick up a cup of coffee, eat a donut, then go back on the streets. This was a woman of the street. She continually did this at this meeting. They finally had a meeting on her. At the business meeting, they said, what are we going to do about her? She keeps coming in, grabbing the donuts, drinking her coffee, and leaving. They chose to do nothing. In doing nothing, they made a decision. And that power greater than us would also make a decision, because one day she came in, grabbed a donut, a cup of coffee, and sat down. This was seen. This could be verified. And when she passed away, she was closing in on 30 years. Interesting. Cup of coffee and a donut. So the next time they argue about coffee and donuts at your business meeting, think about that. I call that the coffee and the donut. There is a... I'll give you a shocker. This one happened in upstate Pennsylvania. Upstate Pennsylvania. There's a few people from my area here. We were there at the event. The area decided to have their meeting up that we rotated around every 3 months. And the night before, we usually traditionally go up to the area, and we go to an AA meeting in that district. We all attended, they bought pizzas and everything, and this group went now from about 6 to 8 to about 35 to 40. As we sat in the meeting, a drunk walked in. I know it's a little shocking, but a drunk, a real drunk, actually walked into an AA meeting. In his arms was a child. The child was terrified. The woman of that home group took the child. The men of the home group took the other man to the back room. The meeting continued. We could hear voices, but the meeting continued. By the end of the meeting, you could hear the child laughing. They took that man home. About a year ago, I went up to that group. I was up there for some reason, for area business. He was making the coffee. It's a miracle. Witnessed? Write it down. I call it the drunk. That's a simple name I give that one. Let me give you another one. This gentleman gets his first coffee commitment. He's not sure he's an alcoholic. He still has a physical obsession. He has it bad. He goes to an AA meeting early in the afternoon. He would have his first coffee commitment that night. Someone behind him opens up a can of Coke. This sound creates an obsession for him. He has a physical obsession to drink because of a sound of a can of Coke. That was going to be his last AA meeting. The voices start talking in his head. He's leaving. He's going out. As he leaves to go out, to go into a bar, he goes for a cigarette and comes out the key to the room that he used to make the coffee tonight. And all he can remember is the woman who gave him the key. She had 30 days less than he did. And he didn't want to hurt her. It had nothing to do with him. He didn't want to hurt him, so aggravatedly, that night he went to the door, opened the door, had a little problem getting in, got in, made the coffee, and here's a strange thing. He would hear another sound. The sound of a coffee pot. As it started hitting the top, it was taking away the physical obsession. A coffee pot. Anyone who has ever made coffee and sat lonely in the room by themselves or reading, the sound of a coffee pot was now taking him in another direction. As he drank the cup of coffee, by the way, he made the coffee because he felt the coffee was terrible in AA. He was in the restaurant business for 20 years. When he made the coffee, he tasted it, and it was the best coffee that was ever made for Alcoholics Anonymous. As he was drinking that first cup of coffee that came out of the pot, the young woman came running in. She said, "How did you get in?" He said, "With the key you gave me." She said, "That's the key to my house. I gave you the wrong key." That key never opened that door again. That is a true story. Both people are still in the program. That's a miracle. I'm going to end with this last one, one on the fellowship, and it didn't happen. The miracle of the key. Well, I wrote that. You want to hear something funny? This tells you how good how sick my thinking is. It's going off the bar for a minute. I'm down there in the archives, and I'm looking around, and I'm saying, you know, I know how we can make a buck here. Nothing original. It's been done in AA since its beginning. We can talk about Jimmy B, Hank, and a lot of other people. I'm saying, you know, if I could get everybody to write a letter to Greg of a general service, the next international, tell them to bring the couch, Bill's couch. Now, everybody wants to sit in Bill's couch. Well, we sell it at $10 a pop. We let them sit there, get the picture taken. Now, this is the icing on the cake, so we get more money in. Here's the icing on the cake. I know how we can create more groups because we don't send them the pictures. They get a coffee pot and a resentment for waiting on the pictures. But that's how sick my thinking. Anyway, I'm going to give you the last story. This last story did not happen in Pennsylvania. This last story happened in Eastern Europe, and it's in one of our conference books, if I'm not mistaken. Our trustees were over there when the block came down, and they decided to hand out the big books in their language. And they went up to this man, and they said, "Here's your book." And the man looked up at him and said, "I have your book. I have no one to show me." Nice statement about the fellowship. Thanks for letting me share.
In a interesting twist of events, apparently some numbers of years ago, I think I was a delegate back in about 1993, this fellowship attempted to create a book known as The Second 25-Year History of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was interesting. And we went through, I believe, three sets of writers, a couple of lawsuits, but who's counting? And ended up with a product that, at the end of the day, couldn't even stay on the shelf in rough draft form. And the conference at that time was so sideways in the whole project. A lot of us had an investment in the fact that we had about $500,000 of the fellowship's money wrapped up in this thing. Some of us were invested in the fact that they thought the language was not proper, not correct, and we all had harpoons that we were shooting at this project. We couldn't get together on it. The thing was put aside so that the people element would get out of the way. 2 years later, they had an even worse review, and so that project got shelved. And it leads one to an obvious question, and the question is whether we as a fellowship can ever write another piece of original material again. Because of our processes and because of the fact that we're such a wide variety of experience and participation and at all levels, and one would begin to wonder the obvious. And the obvious question, of course, is will that 25-year history, that second 25-year history that takes off from St. Louis in 1955 this way, will that ever be written? I submit to you folks, it is being written right now by you, by the archives committees, and by the folks that are doing that kind of work right now from the documents. And DJ brought up a tremendous point, the point of writing down this stuff as it goes, and that somewhere along the line some of us will come up with a way that we can write that history. And guess what? It's probably not going to be on a national level or a worldwide level. About all we can do at that level is take the bullet points from you and start putting them up in a chart or in some kind of a broadleaf or some kind of a drive-by shooting looking history of the world in AA. That's how it'll happen. But the details where the devil lies will be in your hands. And so if you're attempting to, thinking about, even in your wildest hallucinations, starting a collection, a history of Alcoholics Anonymous, perhaps in your area or your local intergroup, as we have it here, beware the covenant. I think it's an implied covenant, but I think it's certainly true for us that we have an obligation to truth, not to the ones that are necessarily here, but the ones that are being born right now, the generations yet to come. We want this thing to be here. I close with a little story. The importance of what you do. How many of you are familiar with the story of Sally wore a blue dress to school on Tuesday? It goes like this. Sally wore a blue dress to school on Tuesday, and that story is translated to one set of ears. The second set of ears picks it up. Sally wore a blue dress to school on Tuesday. To the third set, Alice wore a blue dress to school on Tuesday. No, it was Sally. Okay, whatever. The fourth set of ears picks it up. Alice wore a red dress to school on Tuesday. By the time this gets through 8 or 9 sets of ears, Mabel's a hooker on Colfax on Friday night. Therein lies the dilemma of the oral history. And therein lies the challenge to each and every one of us under the umbrella of I am responsible. I am responsible to share fact, not fiction, truth, not mythology. And let's do away with the AA folklore, shall we? I think I'd like to have another hand for our presenter. I will go ahead and leave these pieces of related errata up front for your taking pleasure. And all things, I believe, are in order. Why don't we close with a recitation of the responsibility statement, please?